The Guardian. Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, and 24/7 support. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
This is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark. At the start of a new year in Westminster, the fur is already flying. Nick Clegg turned 47 this week and celebrated by tearing into his Tory counterparts over their plans to cut benefits while protecting pensioners. Meanwhile, the starting gun's fired on a year of First World War commemoration and the battle begins for the political high ground. And we salute our friend and colleague, Simon Hoggart, The Guardian's much-loved sketch writer who has died at the age of 67. And joining me for all of this, we have The Guardian columnist Michael White, leader writer Anne Perkins, and the political diarist Hugh Muir. A warm welcome to you all. Before we turn to party machinations, however, let's consider a long-running saga that has stirred deep political feelings of another kind. Mark Duggan, the man whose shooting by the police stirred riots across the English towns, has been ruled to have been killed lawfully by police officers. Anne Perkins, you've followed this. He wasn't carrying a gun, and yet it was lawful for the police to shoot him. Does that mean anyone else who's not carrying a gun should be very afraid?
It seems a very perverse decision, but the jury, who had sat and considered this for more than 3 months, were asked to consider a very precise and particular set of questions, and they believed the evidence of the officer who shot them, that he believed at the time of the shooting that Mark Duggan was armed and it was self-defence, proportionate self-defence. And that was the case, and that's the law, and I think we have to respect that conclusion.
Hugh, do you worry it's a dangerous precedent at all, or do you agree with them?
I think it makes for very difficult politics, because you have these procedures, you have these processes in the hope that it will give us some clear explanation and some level of closure. And it clearly hasn't done that, because, as Anne says, you have the unlawful killing verdict, but they also have the inquest jury saying that he didn't have his gun in his hand at the time. And that makes some sense in the strict interpretation of the law. But then you go beyond that and think, well, will communities be satisfied by that? And so there's almost this gap between the reality of what the law says, and perhaps the jury were right, and what the community feel. And in a way, that's where politics comes in, because you're then looking at people like the Home Secretary and the Commissioner of the Met, who are going to have to look at the thing in the round and say, well, do we have any coherent explanation of what happened now after the inquest? And then you're going to have the situation that falls into the lap of someone like David Lammy, the Tottenham MP, who has a job now of reflecting the concerns of the community in Tottenham. That's one of his jobs. But also, he also has to have a very cold-eyed look at what actually transpired at the inquest. So when he goes and sees government, if he has that kind of meeting, he's not just reflecting the emotion of the community, but he's also reflecting what actually came out of the inquest. He has to have a very, in a way, he's motivated by both his heart and his head. I think it's quite a difficult trick to pull off.
So kind of messy facts, Mike, landing everyone in difficulty about what to do.
Yes, next. It is difficult, and it's difficult not least of all because you have the threat of a major street riot hanging over the proceedings.
I think that's unlikely.
Listening to Mr. Duggan's aunt on the radio today, she seemed much calmer than she did outside the High Court yesterday, so that's good. But a bit of balance here. Everything the colleagues have just said is true. On the other hand, see it from the police point of view, the police misbehave in this city, though nowhere near on the scale as happens in many others. Unaccountably so. The fact is, whether Mark Duggan was a gangster or not is beyond my competence, but the police say he was a gangster. He got photographed with gangsters. He had an uncle who was a serious gangster in Manchester until he was murdered by a fellow mobster. He sings gangster raps, and nobody disputes that he picked up a gun from this fellow who is now in jail for gun trading shortly before he was shot. How the gun got out of the car, I don't know.
But
this was a gangster who'd had a gun with him.
But Mike,
they shot him and they shouldn't have killed him.
Mike, that stuff gets you arrested. It doesn't get you shot in the street. And if that does happen, then we have to have a clear idea as to why.
A man with a reputation for violence like that, well, you'd take that copper's position. I wouldn't. It's a bad business all around. But the fact is, he was a gangster with a gun.
I think actually... You know, you need to step in time back a couple of paces from the actual shooting. There were a huge number of people involved in apprehending Mark Duggan. I think most of them were armed and they would all have been understandably scared. And Duggan himself would have been scared. Again, you know, when John Charles de Menendez was shot, there are lots of reasons for being sympathetic for the police being seriously jumpy on that particular day of all days. But nonetheless, there were a huge number of armed police, you know, working as a, you know, they would say a team, but it can look suspiciously and dangerously like a pack.
But John Charles de Menendez was easier politically because I think that generally people would had more sympathy for him, frankly, because they just saw him as being an ordinary guy going to work. This is politically a much more difficult case because of Duggan's background. And you know, one doesn't have to buy into to Mike's characterisation or the characterisation that one reads in the Daily Mail. But the question you have to answer is...
You're saying it's untrue, Hughie.
I'm not even saying that. I'm saying in a way it's not relevant because if we have laws and protections...
It was relevant to the policeman that day, believe you me, and I don't know any of them.
Our problem is that we have been through an entire process looking at this issue and we still don't really know what happened. That is the big problem. His background isn't really the problem. What the officer believed at the time the shot was fired, that isn't really the problem. The problem is that we still don't have clarity. And when things like this happen on the streets of the capital, we must have a process that brings us to clarity.
This one is going to run and run. We're only days into 2014, however, and we've already had a taste of what it's likely to be a rough and tumble political year. George Osborne has locked horns with Ian Duncan Smith and angered Nick Clegg with a new pledge to cut a further $12 billion out of welfare by 2018. Clegg called them lopsided and unbalanced and took aim at a pet project of the Chancellor, an arcane scheme in which workers can trade some of their employment rights for shares. Now, Mike White, there's a harder edge now to Nick Clegg's criticism, it seems, of the government's own economic policies. Is he going to do anything more than usual about it, though, or is he just letting off steam?
Well, as you said in a different context a moment ago, it depends which paper you read. According to the Mail, he is holding the government to ransom. There's a column I haven't had the strength to read in the Mail today saying it's time Cameron stood up to Clegg and his brutal troops. It's been hard to buy that about Nick Clegg. He always seems a bit of a sort of slightly self-pitying chap himself, a bit of an Eeyore. But the fact is, he's learned how to govern within a coalition this last year or so. Whenever I see him, I think he's getting better at it. So he manages not to overstep the boundaries, but to nonetheless make his positions publicly different and publicly clearer. Of course, politicians sometimes do that to each other within parties. There's a great standoff between Gordon Brown and Tony Blair, which Brown certainly made his position pretty clear, didn't do him much good in the long run. But so you can do it. There's a way of doing it. And Clegg has learned to differentiate without overstepping the boundaries, just like Norman Tebbit and UKIP, really.
And do you feel it's like said to be at the start of the year that people put in more divorce applications? Do you think we're heading that way, or do you think this is just a bit of positioning that was always part of the grid?
Well, it's terribly dull of me to say so, but I think it's much more positioning than divorce, and it's politics. But I think at the same time, the Tories are also hardening their position. I think we're going to see a much more abrasive relationship and a much more publicly abrasive relationship. Mind you, it's not just going to be between the two coalition partners. It's certainly got some good spat shaping up within the Conservative Party and probably within the Lib Dems as well.
But when you hear, we'll come back to within the parties in a moment, but when you hear Nick Clegg talk about the Conservatives' monumental mistake in how they want to balance the books on the back of the working poor or whatever, you know, until now, while they've argued about civil liberties and things, they've not argued on their core reason to be, bringing the deficit down. Isn't this dangerous for them?
I think it's unavoidable for them. When Osborne comes out with such an aggressive line on deficit reduction, I don't think Clegg really had a choice but to be equally strong in rebuttal. And I think that, you know, Osborne's appealing to the people who just are philosophically inclined to have a smaller state. Now, Nick Clegg might be an Orange Book Lib Dem, but he's not a small state man.
I love the fact that Nick Clegg exclaimed, oh my God, they want to pare back the state. And did he not know that? I mean, it reminded me of the Inspector Dreyfus at the end of Casablanca when he says, my God, there's gambling here. I'm shocked. I suppose in terms of differentiation, I think everyone's got to differentiate this year, haven't they? Labour, the Lib Dems and the Conservatives, because that election ain't so far away.
And you think if everyone understands that's the game, everyone will be able to work around it?
I think they do. I think they may not agree on much, but I think they probably do have to agree that they, with a little while before, or not very long before the election, that they have to have some dividing lines. And so I think they'll be cross about each other in public and probably not so much in private.
Because I'm sort of one of nature's optimists, I kind of like to think that maybe we'll have some serious political discussion in the coming year, because everyone's got to answer the question about how you do, what your priorities are and how you manage them in an area of very stretched finances. And I think that could actually make nerds like me and Mike, at least, and I know you, Tom, don't know about Hugh, think is really interesting.
This is shrinking the state thing's interesting, and I'm surprised that not more has been made of it by the opposition, because that was what was widely said right at the outset, that the government was saying we've got a terrible deficit, we've got to go into the austerity, and we were saying, well, actually, you want to shrink the state, this is what you wanted anyway.
Sometimes they said that as well.
Well, I don't know why more isn't being made of that, because clearly now they're talking in those terms, and then there isn't there an ability to say, well, look, this is, we told you that was the underlying philosophy behind all of this at the outset.
Mike, I mean, is it a problem for Cameron? He used to say he was the man who didn't come into politics to make cuts.
Well, he will also say that he didn't come into politics to pick up the pieces from Gordon Brown's over-optimistic, under-regulated economy, which fell apart in 2008. He changed his tune not long before Gordon Brown, mind you, so we don't give him much credit for that. He said at question time yesterday, as part of the narrative, well, of course, we're picking up Labour's failed drink laws, 24/7 binge drinking, we're picking up gambling, we're picking up their mess of the banking system, and that resonates a bit with voters. On all three scores, actually. So he's got a bit of slack there, a bit of leeway. And I don't think British voters, although they don't have a neurotic attitude towards the government, the state, that American voters do, nor do Canadians next door, actually, they don't particularly love the state or the government. It's not very lovable. Even the NHS, our favourite nationalised institution, our secular religion, has had a pretty tough year or two for failings.
John Harris is arguing that the state's yesterday and the new product is all local.
It's never yesterday. You've only got to say Syria to realise the state is a really handy thing to have around. Maybe if we have trouble again, I'm sure we won't, with rioters, you can be sniffy about the state, but you'll miss it when it's gone.
Another subplot that's been around, Anne, is Michael Gove, who's looking in a slightly sticky position and is going to war with Nick Clegg in a...
Going to war with everyone. It's 1914, don't you know? The Triple Alliance has, got its railway timetables to meet. Troops to the front.
Well, that's certainly one fight, Anne, that that Gove has picked is with Baldrick from Blackadder, because he's saying that we're looking at the First World War in the wrong way. And, of course, Labour's shadow is a professional historian, Tristram Hunt, and Boris Johnson's called for him to resign for having written the wrong thing about how the First World War started. Where do we end? Are we going to start scrutinising politicians' university essays?
We might actually start by deciding whether we're talking about how the First World War started, which is a subject of mind-bending complexity and mind-numbing tedium, or how the war was conducted, which are two completely separate issues, and they were conflated again on the radio just this morning. But I mean, I think that's, I love a good historical argument. Who doesn't? And it's fine. But Michael Gove has got a very clear idea of what he thinks, British national identity should be, much clearer when he's proselytizing than when he's actually engaged in a conversation, when he's actually very interesting. And
it's difficult, though, because I don't think the government wanted this centenary to be as political as that. And there were reports yesterday that in Cabinet, a lot of people were looking askance at Michael Gove and saying, we didn't want to be in this place. We're now in this row. It's become a very political row and we really didn't want that. And so, I mean, I think his problem is that he is political about everything. And so he couldn't just write, as the Education Secretary, an article about the First World War. He had to get his licks in against the left. But sometimes that works and sometimes it backfires. And this is looking to be one of those cases.
It's even worse than Hugh says. He's very political about everything, yes, but he's also a journalist. And he just knocked off a column for the Daily Mail. His wife's a journalist. She knocks him off every week for the Daily Mail.
It's very hurtful that you should talk about them in those terms, I think.
Yeah, I'm so sorry. But it's kind of slick, easy stuff. And he's a man who punches below the belt. Poor old Tristram Hunt, professional historian. A man who doesn't punch below the belt. Gove pulverizes him whenever they get near each other because he's more of a hooligan. And as to the causes of the First World War, it's a bit like the Duggan inquest. I'm not being frivolous here. We still don't know the reason why the First World War happened, except a lot of people made a lot of mistakes in a tight situation in July and August holiday season, and got it all wrong.
Do you think it's going to be one of these things that runs all year and people kind of take a different view on what it says about Britain? And should we be proud of it, or should we be ashamed of the fallen flowers of England?
I think the enduring argument is about kind of how we use history to shape our national identity, and that's what Gove was really interested in. I would love to hear Tristram Hunt advancing the Stuart Jeffries line on the First World War and the Workers' War, which is a really interesting and unstated case, and there's plenty of meat on that bone.
I think when we actually have the event, when we get closer and we actually have the event itself, that will be done very well. What will be interminable will be all the discussions beforehand.
Somebody said the wars of people will be more terrible than the wars of kings, because you can't compromise. You have to have total surrender and all that stuff, and it's a dreadful thought.
Well, it'll all be over by Christmas. But now, it's with great sadness that we report the death of The Guardian sketchwriter Simon Hogger following a long illness. He continued his popular column up until his death last Sunday. A year ago, he published a compendium to mark 20 years of writing about Parliament and its colourful cast of characters.
Mr. Fabricant's hair, never very securely anchored to his head, began to shake. His whole body twitched like a steam engine about to explode. He coughed. He shuddered. He clasped his groin like a nervous slip fielder who sees Brian Lara emerge from the pavilion.
Mike, his job was to be beastly about politics, but his lasting appeal was that he had a sort of transparent affection for Parliament as well, and a humour that was biting without being bitter, do you think?
Well, he could be bitter and he could be biting, but basically he was anarchic. And frankly, Simon was funny. That's really the secret of it all. It's very difficult to do that. I've tried. And believe you me, it's very hard to be occasionally as good as Simon was most days of the week. One of the obits, I think it was the Times this week, said, you know, they and Matthew Paris invented the sketch. It isn't true. A generation ago, Bernard Levin of The Spectator and Con Welsh of The Telegraph, and of course, a long time ago, a fellow called Boz, who wrote for the morning papers, I don't know what became of him, sketches of Boz, went off to write novels. It's been around, and there was a guy, late Victorian, called Henry Lucy, Sir Henry Lucy, he became, who wrote sort of cheeky things about politicians. So it's a long British tradition, completely incomprehensible in America. It wouldn't last 5 minutes. They'd shoot the sketch writers. But it's wonderful in the right hands, and Simon was the right hands. All week he's just been making me break out with laughter. And here in the Guardian's room in Westminster, where I'm talking, room 15 in the press gallery, we sat around the other afternoon telling Hoggart stories, and somebody said, you know, we ought to book a restaurant and just spend an entire evening trading stories about Simon.
I was, Mike, talking to Ewan McCaskill, who you'll remember as chief political correspondent in Room 15, and he and I were saying that when we were both there, that listening to Ewan Simon winding each other up was easily the best row in the West, best seat in the West End, and we enjoyed it very, very much, and never laughed so much before or since.
A couple of years ago, I edited the Bedside Guardian, our compendium of the best things of the year, and it quickly became apparent that basically I was kind of editing the best of Simon Hoggart. It became very difficult to actually leave any of his stuff out. It was just incredible. And more recently, I was reading one of his books. We put out collections of his writings.
Occasionally, 20 of them, and every column he shamelessly plugged them. It was quite one of his appeals was that he was, in my book, Snipcock and Tweed, 5 guineas. He always did things. That part of his made people laugh.
So a genius and a marketing guru. But I quickly realised that I was reading his book and everyone was looking at me in the carriage, and it was just because I was laughing uproariously. I was in this little world that Simon had created for me, giggling at what he'd written. And I pay no better tribute than that.
There was a famous exchange in the Press Gallery bar, which Anne knows well, where a rather solemn columnist came past and said, Simon nursing a drink, of course, Simon, I saw a man in the tube the other day reading your column and he wasn't laughing at all. Simon replied, quick as a flash, I saw a man in the tube reading your column too, and he laughed all the time.
Well, that's all we have time for this week. My thanks to Michael, to Anne, and to you. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks very much for listening.